you have a central core through this, and then you have your two ends, and then you weld this, you heat up the whole thing, which is expands, and then as that cools, it stretches this to make it even stronger across this distance. You go beyond, this is 30 inches. The first one we did was 24. I would gather that some of those, I'm not sure how those were built at Tandem. I don't know if they're solid or what they did.
No, they aren't solid.
But they are stress welded?
I don't know whether they're stress welded, but they've got inserts. And they vary in terms of the number of discs.
That would be one answer to more length. And but you can take this 30-inch one, and you can do. Remember Dickinson?
Yeah.
She had an etching that was 2 inches square with a mosquito on it. I mean, she burined in a little mosquito. And she came out here and she ran it through the center of this press. She says, if it'll pick it out of that, she says, I'll buy the press. And, of course, we got a perfect print. And but it that, the theory is, of course, that the longer it is, the more possibility there is for deflection. And that I don't mean to get into this except that this was it at that time. This is 1960. There were no presses. I couldn't have done it. I did it with a good number of bottles of wine and the good advice of my engineer friend McPhee, and we put together the prototype, which is still running. And but I just wanted one, and then we got to improving them, and we did some more prototypes. And then, of course, all the students that had had experience with these presses wanted them. So I tried to disengage myself from it, but everybody that bought them had to be, you know, you had to, they varied sufficiently from the ordinary press that I spent hours on the phone talking about this and how to print with it. There are some; it has some unique characteristics that are not common to other print presses. So.
Does it have a name?
Meeker McPhee Press.
You know, one of the things that I like the best about it, and I think that you really started something with, are the micrometers.
Yeah.
Because up until this time, the intaglio presses of the world, the printmakers working on them would count the threads of the pressure screws.
Right, and many, many tests.
Yeah, which is not extremely accurate way to set a pressure and come back to that pressure, you know. So there. And I still think those are the most accurate, easy, micrometers, you know, every press.
Well, Brandt copied those full 3-4 years
and
after.
And his are so much cruder. You have this disc that's sort of a few numbers on it.
Right.
But and I don't think that bunches. I don't like bunches micrometers. They're very inaccurate. They are. It's the dial with the needle, you know. And you take something through the press, and the dial shows something different. Then, I mean, the pressure, the dial is so sensitive that it's always changing.
Yeah.
It doesn't really show you an accurate.
Well, kids, of course, can screw up presses, and they twist, they just twist them off. But they are replaceable, and also with a little bushing metal in that cup, you can adjust. If it tends to print at the same sitting, a little lighter on one side, you put in a little bushing metal.
A penny.
One of my. Yeah, a penny does fine. Or if that's too much,
copper or
lead.
Copper penny, please.
Yeah. Well, so...
What you're talking about is technology being the handmaiden to your expression. Mm-hmm. And what is it you wanted to say visually with the kinds of developments you were making here? How did that assist you in that regard?
Well, going backwards and what developed from it was that I could combine, with this kind of pressure, I could combine color and on a plate that was deep, and in this kind of thing, an eighth inch is deep compared to, say, a Buren line that is 1/32nd, it allows, this press then allowed me to pursue not only color, but a kind of, unique attack on the print, on the plate, which allowed also, at school I had taught etching for some time, and the acids and the things that could happen to students around acid bite used to keep me awake nights. I worried a lot. You see kids dumping plates in and going off to class, coming back, and it just gallon of nitric acid, which could eat your shoes off, and they're talking to each other and dumping this stuff in. There were a number of things that just didn't fit my feeling about etching. So it allowed me to, this press and the experience I had in Paris with Kaiko allowed me to bring together the idea of a more pressure and a combining of the plate and silkscreen color. Now I find there's another development now that since I had to go to work and find out about non-toxic paints, even as late as 85 and 88 in silkscreen, when OSHA got on everybody's case about these paints, which were, I don't know, I've worked in toxic paints since I was 19, and I've escaped this whole thing, and I can understand how it is a danger. Anything's a danger around students, but it you wonder. I read books now about they have found that walnut wood is a threat. You know, I think what if I'd have known all this, I wouldn't have done anything.
You'd probably be dead.
Yeah, right. By something falling out of a window or something. To get back to the subject, I had to learn about water-based paints. Well, they're okay. They warp your paper. They do a number of things that you have to work around. Some of my grad students were coming out here and printing their paper with oil paint and then taking them back and printing water on top, because the oil paint doesn't buckle the paper. But in the process of all this, I got to looking at them with a glass and find out that there is a possibility, except with the thinner paints, that you can get a semi-penetration of those pigments into the paper. And were I still doing this, it would be very much easier now to combine silkscreen and the intaglio plate, because it goes into the surface, whereas the silkscreen was inclined to sit up on top and be rejective. Which is, but I don't do that anymore. As Hayter says, I don't think that way anymore.
Well, you mentioned the relief part of this. Is that a sort of preparation for your sculpture, or you've been doing
Well, I had always had an interest in sculpture, but I'd never thought of them as a as interchangeable, though I use the, you know, the same subjects many times. I've got a Joseph's coat in silkscreen, I got a Joseph's coat in bronze, I've got I've got one in intaglio. But I was thinking about this and anticipating some of these, if there is any logic in your life, you try to run it down. But there was a transition. I did these paper pieces, which are higher. They almost, you could say they're emerging off of the paper and into the room. And that, of course, was the next step. I spent 2 years doing paper. And you see them all up there on those racks. I love the relief, but I missed the color. And unless I went ahead and painted them or used dyes and get up in a lot of cosmetic coloring, I didn't see the reason. They are hard to make. You can't sell them for a great deal. They're hard to store and impossible to ship and expensive to frame. That takes care of that. I moved on.
Negative.
Are you making your own paper? Or
Yeah. Right. Well, you buy linters and beat them up. And oh, yeah, I was gung-ho. I had students out here laying up these papers, and I had that whole end there filled with those pieces, and the mice they loved them, and they shit on them and chewed up the corners and everything. And I finally said enough is enough. I'd been working with bronze and before, and the projects I built this. Sculpture studio 3 years after I was in this one. A print studio, in my mind, has to be a place of some order. It has to be clean. It has to be, the sinks have to be clean to soak the paper. It's a generally a clean hands thing. Except, of course, for putting the ink into the, rubbing the ink into the intaglio. But I used to wear white gloves. I would, instead of washing my hands 15 times a day, I would put the ink in and then wipe off the excess and don white gloves for the handling of the paper and so on. But there was two, I was wondering this morning, you know, if my life would have been simpler if I'd have stayed with Prince. I think there was a time, and I speak only in my own thinking about this, that this studio was built with Prince. I did not build this as a result of my salary increment at the university. As a matter of fact, this was a supplement all the time. Prince have been very good to me. They have gotten the thing about Prince is that you can get them all over quickly. You're in a national show, it gets a little prize, you're out of the edition, and you're on to another. It's truly negotiable art, and it's quite a different, and the people, I would say, I don't want to go into a sociological thing here, but printmaking people are quite different than sculpture people, and the print, they either like it or they don't. They think it's too much, they acquire them if they want them, and they are, I'm surprised now that people come back and want prints from the 50s. There are 50s print collectors now. And they are spooky because they are $500 a print on prints that I used to give away to babysitters.
$1,000 a print.
Yeah, right. Yeah. And You know, I think, when I'm piling up something out in the garage and you ask logically, where does this go? You think, well, if I'd done an edition of Prince in that time, I might know where it was going. But I also have been, and this is in tune with the times. There used to be a time when you couldn't give away sculpture, and now there is a tremendous interest in it, and it comes at a time, it's almost too late. I wish I'd been, you know, I wonder why I wasn't doing this sooner. But in kind of summary on the printmaking, I always think of Paul Klee's statement that art is process, and I've always been interested in process. The newer the process, or the more experimental the process, finding out if you can weld an object into the shape of a horn was a very exciting process, and I'm hung up with this. I have a new machine now, a plasma cutter. I don't even know the theory behind it. It cuts with air and electricity. There's no gas. But yeah, you can do wonderful things with that, and that essentially interests me. I'm at a time now where I've sold enough sculpture. I can indulge in all the machinery, tools. A lot of tools I buy, I don't even know what they do.
There's a great sense of the human form in a lot of your work. Did you have any training in anatomy? Study of the form, and how did that evolve in a lot of what you were doing?
Well, life drawing at the Art Institute, and by, it must be said, by Boris Annisfelt, was a high priority. You had to draw the figure. It was understood that you had to draw the figure before you drew the rest of the world. And so I got very interested in it, and I actually did plates and had my own Thompson's Anatomy book, and we got really involved in this. And then I was here at the university, and it was one of the few things that you're always looking for things that you can tell people about, and that was one of them. I could, although we've had people teaching anatomy, I mean life drawing, who didn't have that kind of background, that did very well. I mean, I don't think it's an absolute by any means. It's just I happened to get interested in it. I thought I was reasonably good at it, and I could teach it. And of course, anything that you teach, I bless the people that can teach things that they don't get involved with. But when I, and as late as the 2 years before, or the year that I retired, I got a figure modeling class again. I taught it way back in the dark ages, but I had a figure modeling class, and I had everybody in the place doing up these 36-inch models, and that's how all these last ones developed. After you correct 12 students on proportion and everything else from a model, you just carry this home in your head, and so I started putting these things together out of styrofoam. They're fast, they're cheap, it doesn't make any real difference whether they are great statements, but they feed an interest of mine that I've always had in humanist subject matter. I would say
there's a great deal of classical tone to your work.
Yeah.
Does that go back to the kid from
Montana going to Greece?
Yeah.
Yeah, I've been, and I come home from Greece, of course. It was only slightly worse than coming back from Mexico, though. I spent a year in Mexico, and Pardon?
One night. He spent a year in Mexico one night.
One night. No, I was there for, I guess, 11 months. But that the Maya got me. I can show you examples of it just, and also again, their interpretation of the figure. Mm-hmm. The figure comes in and out of history like a cork. It used to bother me, except that I finally found an explanation of it that someone at Northwestern described. The pendulum of humanism swings back and forth. And rather than being a lineal thing, it's a pendular thing. And the figure comes and goes, and artwork in the past 10 years. In the 50s, during abstract expressionism, you would rather be caught dead than trying to do a figure. You know, that was out, or anything identifiable. How to do a painting without anything identifiable in it. And that had I love those guys, you know. In Paris, when I was living there, we had the Americans came there, and Pollock and all these guys. And I was, you know, first time abroad, I could say, yeah, that's one of our boys. But I've always been interested in the figure. And it swings back and forth. There are things, you know, that styrofoam splat has nothing to do with the figure. But there is usually some element of humanist interest, whether it be landscape or figure.
How much do you work with found objects or things that you pick up in salvage yards, I would guess?
I'm very interested in that, to find this this first Medusa over there with the Hames knobs on her head. The trouble with found objects is that there are a lot of people around collecting these things that don't use them. They collect the antiquers, you know. They're the bane of every artist's existence. And the next time I went, I thought, boy, those Hames knobs are, you know, the Hames on the horse's harness. I thought, those are good. And the next time I found some, I bought those, two boxes full of them for $12. And the next time I find them, they're $100 a piece, you know. So the collecting stuff is a hazard. But to come by these various, I have a guy that's interested in salvage, and he's interested in steel, and I'm interested in any red or any red metal. So he gets a lot of these things. That piece right there has a wing on it. That was a propeller off of a boat, and I had it around here for 5 years, and I finally cut it out and made an organic piece after I'd been to Hawaii. So found objects, of course, are of great interest to me. But there's, like I say, there is the, it's better to get a lot of flat material and exert yourself on them. Like that piece that you looked at with the glass, those are scraps from doing a figurative, that big Minotaur that's up there. When you cut that figure out, Minotaur, and you have pieces left over. Okay, what to do with the pieces? And so then you put them together in some other context. You use up this wonderful material. I just love bronze. And It's a kind of recycling and re-energizing process, but the finding of objects specifically, that it's I knew a fellow in Rome that used to go to the flea market at Borghese, and he would go early in the morning. Bregosian, do you remember him?
I remember him.
Tasteful things he put together. They were gorgeous. But he spent 90% of his time in pursuit of these things. And, you know, the other 10% was assembling them and sending them off to a dealer where he was very successful. So his creative process was almost coming to him at 5 in the morning at the flea market. he'd get over there to get the objects that he needed. And it's a wonderful way to go after things, but it has its hazards and disadvantages.
It's a wonderful flea market.
Yeah, right.
The
world's best.
When did you begin to leave then printmaking and go towards the next stage? And when did you feel that you had exhausted, for the moment anyway, the printmaking?
Well, I've always taught silkscreen, and I don't know. I accused myself many times of teaching it while I was doing sculpture and other things, because I had a great deal of experience with it. I even hired out a year to, many professors in sciences and so whatnot get picked up to by industry, and I was picked up to by Metalcraft Corporation in Chicago to put in there a image. They were in frames, and they did pictures to put in the frames. And so I set up a big shop and installed all their. In the meanwhile, all of the equipment that's now with the polycops and the silkscreen itself has gone through a technical evolution that allows for the copying of color watercolors. I did some watercolors of Motis for this company with his permission. And the technology of this has advanced so far. And I found this mostly from going out into industry.
But that's mostly photo process.
Yeah,
it?
Right.
As opposed to your cutting the film and things like that.
Right, right. But you can be as creative on a piece of acetate as you can on a piece of paper. So that is not a limitation. It's just these kids don't know about glue and cutting pro film and all that. They don't need to. They now do it on a piece of acetate. We shoot it on the polycomp and we wash it out, and they're printing in 20 minutes. But I learned, I suffered some criticism from my colleagues, as I have many times, for going out to industry. But it was an industry I'd been away for 20 years. This is what I found out what was going on and brought it back to school again. So that I don't, and that was the final thrust on getting this place up. That year I spent going back and forth while teaching. So it not only brought all this modern technology, the kids go out of there with absolutely equipped. As far as the technology. So I went ahead and was teaching that when I retired, as a matter of fact. There's been one other development that I think maybe I did out of the whole philosophy now has changed. I used to try to get them to do additions, at least have technical control so that they could do additions to repeat the piece. And now it's anything goes. You print it, and if you don't like it, you paint on it, or you do monotypes now that you only do one with silkscreen as well as etching. But we found some wonderful techniques on monotypes with silkscreen, and also with this water base, it did very well, the monotype. So
anybody writing this down and sort of having a lab notebook as to how you achieve these effects or anything?
Not me. I have twice been approached by companies to do how to do it books.
Yeah.
How to do it books are all over. And they want to give me an advance, but I just, if it's a choice between that and doing something of my own, I just couldn't get around to it.
It's usually the people who are not productive as artists that write the
right.
I mean, there are some exceptions. But,
well, this book of Ross and
Romano,
that's pretty good. You know, they've got a couple of my pieces in there, yeah. So I'm forced to think of it as a valuable book. But their own work, I didn't think.
Have you ever had a problem and gone to their book and found a solution?
No.
I never have.
No. I guess that's the test.
You know,
I hadn't thought of
right.
that.
It doesn't have solutions for complicated problems.
Uh-huh. Right.
Well,
it's like silk screen books. Have you ever seen a really good silk screen book? No, nothing about it. They put something
yeah.
where there was nothing.
For
but
beginners, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I recommend them.
Well, I do too. They still use, that is still being produced.
Yeah.
And it still has two of my prints from 1952
uh-huh.
in that.
Uh-huh.
I mean, you can get it at Borders Books.
What is it?
Well, it's Bigelow and Cohn.
Cohn and Bigelow, yeah. Bigelison. Bigelison.
Bigelison.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's a basic silkscreen.
Actually, one of my students, you remember Lois Johnson?
Yeah, oh, sure.
I think she did just a it's just a what do you call a small book. But she did this, and it's just about the most valuable book I've seen on the subject of silkscreen. I could be biased because she's a former student, but she just, as head of the department there, she put this little, it's about a 10-pager, and it's wonderful. I talked to her and said she ought to put on, she says, no, you didn't write one. I know, that's why you should.
And Beth Grabowski, who was a student of about 5 or 6 years old, more than that, because she worked with me some. And she has a workbook on litho and etching, primarily from Damer and my class notes.
Uh-huh.
And it's been very successful. I mean, it's going to be, you know, mm-hmm. eventually it will be a book. But that's the way these books are written.
Yeah. Or you remember Sister, what's her name?
Yeah.
And she got, she kicked the habit while she was in our place. She put together big raw abstractions, wonderful
yeah.
pieces.
Yeah.
And then she came, used to come to class dressed in bright greens and magentas. And then she married a hairy engineer. And he just came over and measured my press, you know, and set to work doing one. But she was in a calligraph or calligraphy book in which she used her class prints for the examples. I thought that was hitting it pretty strong, but at many of those, she was a little thing, and we had many of them, we had to help her print them. And so she's busted out with this book, and that's fine, you know. I mean, more books the better, but it's something I never could warm to.
Yeah. The only exception, probably Hayter, who as soon as he got the technique going, would write a book about it.
Well, he was also capable of putting out a book to set the record straight. You know, he, on the subject of viscosity particular, which I have some reason to believe he did not invent, but boy, it's in the book, and Moti didn't write one, so that's the way history will.
Now,
Krishna Reddy.
Has written a book,
yeah.
in which he claims.
You think he did it? Well.
I'd like to ask one question, if I could follow up to one that Art asked earlier before. Before you talked about it, you mentioned in your biographical sketch that you got to do that. You started out in painting, and you mentioned that. Whatever
right.
happened to painting?
Well, I just sold one. You can see it. See the square there. well, there they are. I did a lot of painting. The first 2 years I was here, I competed. I got medals at the Milwaukee Art Institute. And then, after 2 years, it occurred to me that I was in possession of all my paintings, all of them. And that tells you something. And I had, I was living at university houses, and I was getting little kids by twos and ones, and I had four kids, and I thought, and you know, the first edition of prints I did, I sold. Well, it doesn't take a genius to figure out that you should, as the New York artist says, appeal to a broader base. I have some, I can't, if, as long as I'm on my tether, I would like to show you a couple of prints and some things that I think have to do with my development as well as the printmaking development in general. And if we could do that, or if I could get loose from this and bring them back.
Do that, and then we can pick up next time, if you're willing to continue the dialogue.
Oh, yeah.
Using
examples.
Okay. And go from there.
Fine. I thought this was a one-shot deal.
Well, no. Well, it's, you know, it's sort of evolving.
Yeah.
With Ray, Ray started slow, but once he got going,
we talked about this.
We went for two sessions.
Oh, that's great.
And, you know, fascinating. Yeah.
Well,
he
Ray,
wants you to say what you feel you need to say in whatever time it takes.
Okay.
And obviously, you're just getting warmed up.
So. Yeah. Well, yeah, I'd hope by going over this stuff this morning that I would. This is a summer's talking into one of these machines is why I to just and also to check some of the things and to put down some people, but I would very much, I've got in my collection, I have Motis and Hathers and some early Colescotts and and some late.
They're Cole's worth more money.
Cole's, well, you know, let me know, and I'll let you know. We threaten each other.
Yeah, I've got, you know, we traded quite easily.
Oh, yeah. And every time I threaten him with showing some of his early pieces, he says, you show my early pieces, and I'll show your early pieces. I'd love to set up over there and to discuss also the development of this serigraph is all in that drawer over there, and we wouldn't have to do the whole thing but just a few isolated examples.
Well, yeah, that's with Ray on the second session. He brought work and we got into his talking about specifics, and it was really very interesting.
He's such a sweet guy, but when you said you were going to interview him, I said, you know, Ray, don't give anything away at the beginning.
He was very wary.
But then, as soon,
he was wary. But he warmed up.
He is so great.
So good. Another session. Could we perhaps set a time
if we can,
and then check calendars and so forth. No.